Hey everybody, I'm Michael.
And I'm Tanya.
And we're a War and Treaty.
And you're listening to Walking the Floor.
With Chris Sifflett.
I'm walking the floor over you.
Walking the floor.
I'm walking the floor. Walking the floor over you.
Hola, senores and senoritas. This is Chris Sifflett. Back with another fascinating episode of your favorite podcast, Walking the Floor. It's been a minute. We made it through the holidays, made it through New Year's. Haven't posted one since I posted the Aaron Reitier episode, so just getting caught back up on things. Took a little longer to get back to the podcast than I expected, but come on, man, it's been busy. Now it's a new year, so it's onward and upwards. Moving forward. Man, there is so much going on. I can't blow the big announcement, but I gotta tell you, got a big announcement coming tomorrow. Big announcement. And it might involve me, like, getting on an airplane and flying to a distant land and playing some concerts. I can't say more, but just tune in tomorrow. I mean, this drops on a Monday, so Tuesday, there's gonna be an announcement of sorts. And some people somewhere might like it, and then other people in other places are gonna go, hey man, why don't you ever come to Poughkeepsie? Come to Brazil, come to Des Moines. You know what I mean? Like they always do. Anywho, we're gonna try to get everywhere, but we gotta start somewhere. I think I just blew the announcement a little bit, but whatever. You're gonna find out soon enough. Hey, and don't forget, the first single from my new record comes out February 15th. It is called Blacktop White Lines, and I've teased it a little bit on my social media, so if you're curious what it sounds like, go to, you know, my Instagram or whatever, and you can find something where it's there's a little bit of the song on there. And I'm really excited because I got a whole album of new songs, and this is the first song coming out, and it's we're going to have, like, pre-save links and stuff soon. So pay attention. I'll be posting more about that, you know, in the coming weeks. But February 15th, Blacktop White Lines. Oh, yeah. Also, I think it might be sold out, but I'm not 100% sure. I'm going out to Nashville to open up for Blackberry Smoke at the fucking Ryman, which is super duper exciting. Can't wait to see those guys. Haven't seen them in a minute, and haven't played in Nashville for a minute either, so like a full show. I was out there at the Grand Ole Opry not too long ago, but I haven't done like a show for a minute, so if you're in the Nashville area, come on out and check it out, man. The Ryman. It's always a good time at the Ryman. I should also mention we had some fantastic shows back in December before the holidays really kicked in. And thanks to everybody that came out, man. Santa Cruz, Santa Barbara, the hometown holiday hoedown. What a good time. Venice. Where else did I play? Tempe, Arizona. Anaheim. LA. Yucca Valley. That one was great. The Awbar. I feel like I'm forgetting something. There's definitely one or two more that I'm forgetting right now. But all the shows were fantastic. So gonna do more of that, you know, in the coming months for sure. All right, let's talk about Zounds.com. Yeah, hey, you know, everything is costing more these days, right? So don't let increased costs prevent you from owning the gear you want. Buy your gear from Zounds.com using one of their easy monthly payment plans. Their gear is really affordable, and you're able to pay for it on a monthly basis instead of all one time. So Zounds lets you do exactly that with their easy monthly payment plans. Zounds.com, the greatest online music retailer in the world. All right, let's get to our guests. All right, this week I got a good one. It's the War and Treaty, a.k.a. Michael Trotter Jr. and Tanya Trotter, husband and wife, singing duo out of Nashville by way of Michigan, by way of Baltimore, if I remember correctly. They've been making some big waves out there in Music City in recent years, and they've got a new record that's produced by Dave Cobb. Some of that's out now. I'm not sure when the whole thing's going to come out, but it's. I know that some of the tracks are up in Spotify, so check that out for sure. We had a great talk. They're super cool. Got into some heavy shit in this conversation, but it was great. This is The War and Treaty on Walking the Floor. You actually pronounced my last name right. That's like unheard of. That never happens. All right, let's jump in. You know, obviously you guys have been around for a minute and you have a bunch of records. You have a few records and you've been making music for a while. But it seems like if you look at like the last year or so of your career, you know, you've not only have you won an Americana Award for Duo Group of the Year, you played on the CMAs and the ACMs with Dirks and Brothers Osborne. And you've got this new record coming out that Dave Cobb produced. I mean, it seems like things are just blowing up. Do you guys have a sense of that internally? Like you've been on the roller coaster and it's clicking up, and it's about to get over that crest at the top and just go bananas.
I don't know even how to answer that because we would have to lean to people like you to for that kind of information, you know, because everything just always feels like, you know, we get up there, we sing it, and it's over. You know what I mean? So, and then we're never expecting to win. Like, we did not expect to win that award with Americana because we didn't feel like we really did. You know, we didn't feel we did much, you know, and it was just a weird thing. But I kind of am learning to be present. And I think that's what it is. It's, I think that Klein and I were so... like we fight to remain like in this place of gratitude and gratefulness and don't really think of trajectory. Right. But it's crazy because as you were talking and mentioning those things, it's like, okay, we did ACMs with Dirks in 21. And then we did CMAs this year with Brothers. And, you know, it's like, well, damn. You know, like you know, like it's all now that it's over. You know what I'm saying, Chris? Like,
yeah, no, I think it's what you're saying is really important and really difficult in the music industry to stay present and to sort of like, you know, experience it as it's happening. I mean, I struggle with that myself over the years. And also you said the word gratitude, like to have gratitude, because in this business, you're sort of in a mindset of constantly fighting, clawing, you know, that's just the nature of it. So it's like when, at least for me, and I'm curious how it is for you. I mean, you just touched on it, but like, that's a hard thing it's hard to remain present.
Well, my wife has been, you know, I get a lot of that being present from Tanya. But the one thing that we do is we have aims, you know, and when I say like, we'll get that from you, like with all the work that you've done and with your projects and then with, you know, the fighters and everything, Foo Fighters. It's like you have these aims. It's like, I want to one day be on a stage with them, or I want to one day, you know, be able to accept this or, you know, these aims. And when those aims actually happen, you're like, holy crap, like, how did I miss that? You know, like you know, and what do you want to say, babe?
Yeah, I would have to agree with Michael on that because I feel, you know, I was watching, I think it was the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame inductees the other day. And one thing that I was really moved by was Eminem's acceptance speech. You know, so when we do shows, we kind of keep in mind that people like Sister Rosetta Tharpe or, you know, Mahalia Jackson,
Big Mama Thornton,
people that were not able to stand on some of these stages and they had done music that may have sounded like country music or rock and roll music and didn't get the accolades that, you know, they maybe have should have gotten
while
they were alive. You know, it's very humbling to be able to have these platforms and be able to be on these stages and share the stages with so many different, you know, people of all different genres. And I think for me, and I guess I can speak for Michael as well, that's a big part of what keeps us, you know, grateful and grounded in all of it, you know?
And excited. Mm-hmm. Like, we're amped up about 2023 in a way that we weren't amped up about 2022 or 21 for obvious reasons. But
yeah, I bet.
2023, you know, we feel optimistic. I mean, like, even being on this with you, it's like, you know, we've been swallowing like for like days, like, oh shit, this is like, I'm sorry, man, Chris. I have a foul mouth, bro. I've been working on it. Oh man.
Oh, hey man, this is a podcast and you can say whatever you want.
Well, you know, I mean, when that kind of thing happens, you know, because it's been on our calendar, right? But we don't really pay attention to the calendar.
Yeah.
And then like a couple of days before, they're like, yeah, you know, you're going to be on with Chris. And me and Tanya both were like, wait, what the hell did you just say? Like, you know, so, but yeah, I mean, it's been that for us.
Yeah.
Awesome. Awesome. Yeah. I mean, I can only imagine you must have a jam-packed year or two or 10 or whatever ahead of you. With this new record coming out that I was listening to that is great. How did you wind up working with Dave Cobb? Is that your first time with him? Because I know you've produced yourselves in the past, right? How come this time around you wanted to work with Cobb?
Well, we inducted Ray Charles into the Country Music Hall of Fame, and we did a song, and Dave was the engineer for the song, the mixing engineer. For the song, and he was mixing it and gave Michael a call and said, you guys need to get your butts down here right now.
To RCA.
To RCA.
Oh, yeah.
So, yeah, because he was, what was he mixing it on, Michael?
Well, the thing is, that's where Ray recorded that song.
Oh.
And, like, you know, like the recording panels and all the fixings that they used to do that is still there.
Yeah.
And so what Cobb wanted to do was he just wanted to put it on our voices just to test the waters to see. And so we got down there, and that's exactly what he had done. Yeah. And we were like, whoa, you know, like, we loved it first off, and we hadn't heard ourselves in that manner. And what Cobb suggested, you know, well, here's how it went. And I produced as well, and I was just like trying to figure out what's the Dave Cobb sauce, you know. So I'm like, why don't you mentor me, man? Like, tell me what you're doing that's making all these things stick, you know. And he goes, well, just do a record with me.
Easy enough.
So, I mean, you know, we've been threatening to work together since 2017, but this opportunity presented itself, and I'm so happy. And also, just as a producer, wanting to learn from others, you know, like,
sure,
what is their thing inside the studio? Now we have stories, you know, we can share with other people and bring up like interviews like this.
I mean, you know, like for you, as a producer yourself, was that, did you enjoy that process of not having to be the producer, to have somebody else to kind of like bounce your ideas off and not having to be kind of like thinking about the whole picture, maybe just thinking about what you're doing?
I enjoyed arguing with Dave, and I told this to everyone. I did, because, you know, he's this big badass, and I'm a big badass. So it's like, you know, let's. I want to make sure that we're not just with you because you've got a name,
right?
I want to make sure your ass is doing some work, you know, and making sure, you know, that's for real. And
yeah,
and we're not going to back down. If I feel that he's wrong about something, I'm going to let him know. And if he feels I'm wrong about something, and those are two producers in there, but realizing that, well, one producer has a proven track record of being right.
Yeah.
And I don't, you know, so, I mean, I enjoyed learning from him, and I enjoyed being in his studio in Savannah, Georgia, and watching how he handles and treats his musicians in the studio.
Yeah.
Right. Who were the musicians? Was it like Chris Powell and Brian and those cats playing out?
Nice. Oh, yep. Definitely. Like, two of the most, in my opinion, and you may have a different opinion, Chris and Tanya, but two of the most underrated, and I feel slightly underappreciated, not by Dave, but I think the industry doesn't realize the gift it has in musicians.
Yeah.
You know, like, I feel that has been a thing for years. You know, we try to fix it by putting out there, you know, these snapshots of who played on the album, and it's like, yay. And we think that that's enough. But, like, it's so much more than just who played on the record. Like, who lent their spirit to this? Like, right. Who gave? Like,
yeah.
Brian and Chris and Phil. Phil was on keys. When they close their eyes, you can see them seeing the music and not hearing it.
Yeah.
Right, right.
Which is different. You know, like, yeah. you can hear something all day, but when you see it, you know, it's like it's getting inside of your bloodstream now. Now you've got no choice but to travel because you can see this piece, you know. And that's what they did, you know.
You know, it's interesting because I feel like people that know Chris and Brian and that whole crew, you know, Dave's sort of got his wrecking crew of musicians. Like, if you know, you know. You know what I mean? Everybody that works with them is like, oh, yeah. It's funny, you know, you talked about, you know, sort of getting into it with Dave over production stuff. I remember because I made a couple records with Dave myself. And I remember before the first one, before I went out there, my wife was like, why don't you do something you never do and like listen to everybody else? I was like, that's good advice to go into that, you know, to go into that thing with. But, you know, he's got a very specific process to how he works, you know, and he doesn't like to overthink it. And I tend to overthink it, you know what I mean? And so that was like, it was a challenge for me to like, you know, wait, we're only going to do three takes. We got it. Are you sure? You know, that kind of thing. How, like, was it similar for you guys? Did you do that thing where you kind of like play the song in the room, work it out real quick, jam it a couple times, and then you're off to the races?
Well, for me, I am really like anal retentive when it comes to vocals. So Michael will say things and Dave were like, it's done. It's fine. We don't have to do it again. And in my mind, I'm like, no, I'm going to do it again. And they leave and go downstairs and leave me in the room with Brian, the engineer, because I'm trying to make it perfect. But then, you know, the balance is realizing that sometimes it's just the spirit of the song doesn't need the perfection of the song, you know. And right. I found myself, even in the process with Michael producing the records, I found myself learning how to ease up a little bit, you know, let that scratching your voice be there, because that's the one thing that may make the song make the difference in the song, you know.
Yeah, it was yeah. It, that is how Dave, mm-hmm. you know, you're absolutely right. He'll get like three takes and mm-hmm. he'll look around the room like, yeah, what do you think?
Oh, I'm like, yeah. No.
Dude, are you serious? <Yeah. laughs> And he's in 9 times out of 10 he's right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
you know. And then the one time that we dealt with where he was like, that ain't it. Let's you know, like, you know, it was really cool.
I haven't been down to his place in Savannah, so I would be curious to see what it's like to work with him when there isn't the pull of like, all right, that was, we got that one. Let's go look at guitars at Carter Vintage.
Oh man, yeah. It's weird because it's like home.
Right. Like, is it like, at his house?
When we recorded it was, you know, mm-hmm. I don't know where it is now, but it felt like home. It felt like how we first started working out of our bedrooms when we were, you know, younger and you know, and your wife, I thought you were talking about my wife at the moment because my wife said the same exact words verbatim to me.
Yeah.
Why don't you listen? And I'm like,
right. Yeah. Again, it's a challenge.
Yeah, man. Yeah. I mean, you know, and it's definitely a challenge with Dave because he doesn't allow you to just listen. Like he'll say like to me, he was like, yeah, what do you think? What do you think about that? And I'm like, are you sure you want me to answer that? Because then we're going to get into a conversation here that's going to last for a while. And he's not afraid of that. Like it's really cool work with him. It really feels like a brother. Like, you know, yeah. we have that kind of thing, you know.
He taught me a lot about songwriting, you know, about how to think about songwriting and putting the songs together. And probably the piece of production advice that I took away from that experience maybe the most was I remember we were working on one song. He goes, Man, you don't need, because he's so good at stripping away the fluff out of your song. You don't need that. And you don't need that. No. That's your chorus and, you know, all that kind of stuff. But I remember he said, like, kind of almost out of frustration because I was pushing back on something. He's like, everybody thinks they need that third verse. You never need the third verse. And I think about that now every time I'm writing a song. Like, have I already said this? You know?
Yeah, that's
his
true.
Thing for me was intros. Why are you taking that long? Like, why do we go that long to get to here? Because here's where it is, man. You got to be here. All the other shit. And I'm like, dude, are you really ripping my song apart?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting listening to your records, because like every song is like the emotional power to it that like you wish you had one of those on your record. And it's like song after song after song. It's funny because I grew up listening to like heavy metal and punk rock and stuff. You know what I mean? And the power in that music, or at least how I perceived the power in that music, was big, huge guitars and screaming and bombast and volume. And when I listen to your music, it's actually more powerful, but the power comes from a different thing. It's not bombast. It's like, it's the vocal and it's the emotion and the sort of the weight behind it. You know what I mean? Wow.
Thank you. That means so much coming from you. Thank you.
It's all her. I'm dangling by a thread here.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah. Does she have a knife in your back right now?
Oh God. Like, oh.
Just off camera.
Oh bro. Like there's this one song, called The Best That I Have. I went to use the restroom and I came back and it was a completely different song. I'm talking about key and feeling it. And I was like, what the hell just happened to my song?
Like, let's go, let's do this. And I'm like, come up with it. Come on, let's do it. While Michael's in the bathroom, because it was very vibey, you know, which is different for, you know, the War and Treaty. It was a different kind of vibe for us, but it was... We wanted to do a record that was really vocal driven and kind of stripped down from everything.
Well, he wanted to do
that record.
A record that was vocal.
Yeah.
He wanted us that was the whole idea of this album. It was what he saw us do live. And what many people, you know, whenever we get on stage live, it always feels better. You know, it's like you can do whatever the hell you want and there's no chains, there's no governor there. Mm-hmm. And what he said was, I want to highlight all of that in your vocals. Like, you know, you and Tanya, like, I want the real, I want people to feel your voice. And the instrumentation is just pretty much the palette for that. Mm-hmm. And Tanya and I can launch off, you know, at any given time. But this particular song, he wanted me to sing up in the rafters, like higher than Tanya, like as if, you know, there was like this nut kick. And I mean, Jesus Christ, man, I'm giving you the best that I have. And I'm trying to, but not. Oh. And I feel like an idiot, but it's working. I'm like,
this. You do it naturally. You sing higher than me at every show. Like every single show we do, he's like battling me for the top note, you know. And I'm like, I just leave him up there. So it was perfect that Dave wanted to do a song like
that.
You know, I've never been in a musical relationship with somebody that I'm in a romantic relationship with. So I'm curious, like with your songwriting, how you guys approach that. Like, do you guys sort of like woodshed separately and then bring it together and work on it together? Or do you just write like off the bat together? Like I guess what I'm getting at is just what are the pros and cons of sort of being like in, you know, you're married and you make music together. How does that work?
Well, when we first started, Michael, you know, did a lot, most of the writing for the band. And this was the first time with this record that we actually, well, we've written songs together before. You know, I bring him pieces of songs and he, you know, reconstruct them and make them make sense. And this was the first time we actually opened ourselves up to writing with other people and writing together, you know.
But I think honestly, if I could interject, mm-hmm. I think what we have learned to do is to buy into our togetherness all the way around.
Yeah.
Like, it's not about anybody else when it comes to what we have to do with one another. And, you know, we just gave in to that. It was like, you know what? I love you. I like you. I love being around you. And here's my hobbies. And I would love it if you were around that. And it was vice versa. And we realized that we win that way. Whenever we separate, we lose. I mean, yeah. It's crazy because I can sing a song by myself easily and go whoop-de-doo, you know, and Tanya can go and sing a song by herself and whoop-de-doo, you know, and it's cool. But we tried that in our lives, and it can work for a little bit, but it's not lasting. It doesn't leave a lasting impression. And when we, whatever we do together, it not only does it last, not only does it thrive, but I can tell you the honest to God truth, Chris, it survives anything. So we wrote together, and, you know, we laugh together, we smile together, we eat together. Even when we're in writing sessions with other people, there's that time, there's that moment to where, but if we turn and look at one another, no one else is in the room.
Yeah. Right.
And we've just bought into that, and it makes it, you know, it's easy. It's easy to travel with your wife. I mean, hell, I mean, I think what makes it even easier for me is, you know, if I'm on a stage rocking out and I get a little in the mood, I can always go back to the bus with my wife.
I'm not even gonna touch that one. Well, I am fascinated. I'm fascinated by the whole thing, because, you know, I think about that's like an amazing comfort level. I mean, you guys are married, so obviously there's a huge comfort level, but I think about with my own relationship that sometimes, you know, my wife she's the person I love to bounce things off the most, you know, new songs and things like that. But she's also can be my harshest critic, and it makes me the most nervous to show her something that I'm working on. You know what I mean? So because, you know, songwriting is kind of when you're songwriting and performing, you're totally like laid bare.
Yeah. And you're vulnerable.
Yeah.
And you're, you know, very sensitive to it because it's your art form, you know, but I think it's like what Michael said, once you have that safety and that friendship with one another, and you know that the person is not saying it to hurt you, you know, it's a, you know, maybe this is better. Mm-hmm. And it's always how you approach it, you know, especially the wording. If I just, you know, word it a certain way, then he's not going to receive it. Or if he does the same thing for me, you know, we know each other in that way now, and we can present it to each other where it's not, we don't get defensive, you know?
Yeah.
But we get in our biggest arguments, really, in songwriting.
yeah we do.
It's not about a toilet seat being left up. Yeah. It's not about anything in our house. It's about, oh, so you don't like my chorus?
Yeah.
I told you, you don't need that third verse, god damn it.
There you go.
It's
too big.
Hey, can you guys each talk about just like your history before Warren Treaty? Like, where did you guys grow up? What got you into music? Influences? You know, all that sort of stuff that led to where you are now.
Okay.
Okay.
Well, I started out in the church. You know, one Sunday morning, I saw my brother singing, and I was like, I told my mom, I was like, whatever he just did to make the people fall out on the floor and, you know, catch the Holy Ghost, I want to be able to do that, you know, and I wanted to be able to do it not just in the church setting. So by the time I was a teenager, I was, you know, auditioning around town for different things and entering myself in contests and stuff like that. And I entered myself into a contest where Natalie Cole was the host. And I ended up getting that audition. The show was called Big Break, and flew out to LA. And that was my first time doing something nationally. And from there, I was signed to a record label, Island Records, at 18. And then I went on to do Sister Act 2, where with Lauryn Hill and Whoopi Goldberg. With so many, James Coburn, many wonderful, legendary actors in the movie, and did a song called His Eye on the Sparrow. And then I put out a record, and I was about, I think it was 19 when I put the record out, and it was R&B, And my influences was everything, because my mom was from Panama, so I listened to calypso music growing up. My best friend was a, you know, blonde with blue eyes, so I listened to Nirvana and Cyndi Lauper and all the different kind of music. My dad was from the country, so I listened to, you know, Dolly Parton, and he watched Westerns all the time. And I love R&B music, you know. I loved R&B, I loved gospel, James Cleveland, Mahalia Jackson. My church was full of incredible singers. My brother was a singer. And I just love all styles of music. So by that time, I was in college with a classical music career at 19 and left college to go and pursue music full time. And by the time I was about 24, I was completely like burned out. It was like 10 years of me doing all this stuff. And you look at people from age 14 to 24 and you're like, how can you get burned out? But if you're doing it every day, you're writing, you're trying to claw your way, as you were talking about when we first started the interview, the claw, you know, the trying to get up the ladder, watching the trajectory, you really lose the passion and the art form, you know, for why you do what you do. And so by that time, I was burned out and I went to New York and did some off-Broadway stuff and moved back to Maryland, DC area where I was from, and start doing some community service kind of things. Working with kids and trying to do giving back and doing vocal lessons, just the things that I knew from when I started gave me the passion for the arts. You know, whether it was dance, singing, acting, whatever, my passion was so passionate for it that by the age 14, I knew I wanted to do it. So in 2010, I did a back to school program. It was like a festival. It was called the Love Festival. And we had a bunch of artists that were performing there. And Michael was one of the artists that the young lady I was working with had to come perform. And like I was saying, my passion for everything I was doing was completely like gone by this time. And I was doing some stuff with my brother because he wanted to do music. And you work with your brother too in a band. So that passion was there. You know, I knew my brother had a passion for music, so I put together a duo and we were going to do a record together. And it was more so for him than it was for me because my passion had totally depleted. And I saw Michael on the stage and he was out there with this rock guitarist and they were killing it. And it was literally like when I saw him, the gift that I had inside of me started bubbling up. And it was like, he took a light socket and just put it in a wall and a light bulb went in me. And I was like, I want to do this.
Whoa, now.
Wait. I'm like, this is what I want to do. His passion for this. And it's like 10 people in the crowd was unreal. And that was the passion I had at 14. I remembered it. You know?
Right.
And so
reignited.
And we exchanged numbers and I asked Michael, had he ever written songs for anyone before? And he hadn't. And so he went home and he said, well, I'll go and write some songs for you and your brother. And he came back with like 14 hits in a day. I'm like, who does that? How do you do that? You know?
She's giving me I'm feeling really good about this conversation
right now. Like, this guy's nuts. You know? So we started recording and trying to do some rehearsals, my brother and I. And my brother couldn't make it to a rehearsal one day. And Michael put his vocal on the track. And a friend of ours heard us singing together and was like, do you guys hear that? And we were like, no. You know, by that time, we were smitten by each other and in love. And, you know, I'm feeding him grapes and all the crazy stuff you do when you first meet.
Oh, why you gotta bring up what you're feeding me? How come I can't be feeding you?
Yeah. You're still picking him up at the airport at that point.
So, you know, we get married 3 years later. You know, we were married for 3 years before we
You're way beyond what he
asked. Yeah, he's asking about
Oh, it's good, though. No, it's good. It's good. I like it. I'll keep going. Keep going.
And that's how we got to being the Warren Treaty. From my end.
Well, that's really interesting. So you had early mainstream music biz success and experience, and then that I mean, this is like, you hear stories like this kind of a lot in music, you know, like thrown into the deep end and, you know, moving to LA and making a record and doing all that thing. And then it doesn't work out and you go off and you sort of reinvent yourself and then you come back on a different path. And like this time around with this band, you know, I know you, before now you were on, Rounder, you know, more like an indie level kind of thing. And then now you're back in major label land. Like that's, how has the journey into the music business, like how would you sort of compare those two parts of your career? Like how have you changed with dealing with the industry in that time frame?
I would say that it starts like what Michael and I were talking about earlier, the level of gratitude and staying present at every moment. Because when you're young and you're in it, all you're thinking about is the next. Is you're thinking about trajectory. Am I going to have a hit record? Can I get a song? Let me write with all the hit producers. And this time around, I wasn't even thinking about reinventing myself. I literally was like, Michael, let's never talk about what I did in the beginning. Let's get in the van and let's go do coffee shops. You know, and work out the kinks to these songs, because that's why I got in the music business at 14, because I wanted to keep that passion there. And I've changed because my level of passion and gratitude is there, not just for the music, but for the fan, you know, for my family, for everything. We get to travel with my son. I couldn't do that with my oldest son. You know, we get to have our families around us and come to shows and things like that. The level of gratitude that I have now and understanding that this is really a gift. It's not given to everybody. There are many singers singing in church choirs, busking on the corners that wish they could do what I'm able to do with my husband, the man that I love every day. You know, a lot of artists have to leave their loved ones at home. I get to do this with my husband and my kid, you know?
Yeah.
And it's amazing. So I've changed because, I'm just so grateful. Like I burst out into tears sometimes on stage because I can't believe that it's happened again, you know, again, you know,
and it's working this time, maybe in a way that it didn't work. It's really interesting. And by the way, being able to bring your kids out on the road is like the greatest gift.
Oh my God. Of all.
It really is. I mean, my oldest is now in college and it's so cool to see him out in the world, not living in our house and traveling on his own a little bit with his friends and the way that he's able to navigate stuff. And I think a lot of that has to do with we just took them everywhere, you know, when they were babies. Awesome. Yeah, it's great, man. Enjoy that. So Michael, what's your backstory?
Oh man. Much like Tanya, my first singing opportunity was in Holy Trinity Baptist Church. And I was 3 years old. And I remember it like it was yesterday, man, to be honest, because my grandmother was in the audience cheering me on, you know, telling me I can do it. And that voice, that's my baby. You know, I've always wanted to hear it again, you know. And but it cemented to me that this is what I wanted to do, you know, with the applause and watching other performers, like I think the first performer I ever saw was Michael Jackson. You know,
live?
Man, I think that was the most difficult part of him being my first concert experience, because it's like that's a different
like that. You know? Like that was the bar. That's a high bar.
I had to like, oh boy, you know, like I remember him, but artist that got in my bloodstream, honestly speaking, was Johnny Cash, Ray Charles, Mahalia Jackson. These three artists really shaped me. They really got in me, you know, and it was something about just those three. You know, Ray Charles is the master of just art and technique. And Johnny Cash is just the bad boy. You know, like I just remember just studying his lyrics. And Mahalia Jackson is my center. You know, I don't care what's going on in my life or how far I go. If I throw on some Haley, I'm right back where I belong, you know. But growing up in the hood, that's not a popular thing to share. You know, you talk about the latest hit and everybody's like, well, Pac, you know, I'm big. And I grew up in Cleveland, Ohio, and some Bone Thugs was hot. So I kind of just, you know, stayed away from music for a bit and just really spiraled into jacking my life up. I made like some really serious mistakes, and I dropped out of high school literally maybe a month into the ninth grade. End up having a baby girl, and with my baby girl, my world just really shifted. I needed to do something, and I was working at Babies R Us, and I was getting paid $4.15, and I was like, this is not going to cut it. But they were giving me 50% off on baby items, so, you know, that was a good, smart decision there. But then I went into the Army, and the Army changed my life. I wasn't patriotic, had no inclination that I'm serving during a time of war, because in the hood, you got your own war, you know. But when I joined the Army, I fell in love with my battle buddies, my brothers, for the first time. And then I fell in love with my country, and I fell in love with serving the country and protecting the country. And then I fell in love with representing the country in a real way, even though my skin tone would suggest that I should be the most pissed off individual in this country. I had a sense of pride, you know, by representing the idea of the United States, United States. And I learned to play the piano in Iraq.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
You weren't playing music before that?
No. In fact, I learned to play the piano in Iraq on Saddam Hussein's piano that he owned.
What? For real?
Yeah. Yeah, it's some real weird shit, but it's a piano he owned and he often played, you know, and I learned to play on there. And the guy who showed it wasn't until this guy, this soldier, was killed to where I started to understand the piano. It really unlocked me emotionally. Mm-hmm. And I wrote my first song about that situation, and I performed it in Iraq. And it brought so much healing to the troops that my colonel at the time, Peter Jones, he asked me if I wrote that song. I said, yes, sir. And he said, okay, how long did it take you to write it? I told him about 5 minutes, you know, and he said, okay, good. That's your new job. You're going to go around with me to as many memorials. You're going to write a song, and you're going to perform it. Like, that's what you're going to do. And when I tell you from 05 to 07, like, to the, I got out of military 07, that is what I did. I, whenever there was a military funeral around within my range, I'd go and learn and write a song and perform it.
And, were you doing that at the same time as soldiering?
Nope, that was it. My unit was special. Once my unit found out, and my unit was 1/6 Infantry, 2nd Brigade, 1st Armored Division. Once they found out that I had the gift of healing and music, they were like, oh, that's what you're going to do. That's what we need you here for. We don't need you to fight. Probably a wise decision on their behalf, because I would probably have broke and gotten somebody hurt. But you know, I came out of the military in 07 and I struggled hard because I couldn't get a job in our country, you know, and at the time, if you went to war, that wasn't a favorable thing. I was serving under good President Bush at the time, and a lot of people were angry about this war, and a lot of people were angry about what we were doing over there, and a lot of people were blaming us. And I remember coming home in the airport, and they were throwing things and protesting against us, and it really broke me. And so I decided to hide the fact that I was in the military and still couldn't get a job, ended up becoming a homeless veteran, and all I had was music and my ability to sing and play.
And this is like 07, 08. So this is right in the middle of like the economy cratering. And
yeah. And then I was married and I got a divorce in 09. So, you know, and I got two daughters at this time, and I'm just, all I got is two daughters and a songbook, you know. And but 2010, my luck will change. August 28, 2010 is where me and Tanya link up. And from that moment, you know, I realized like we had an opportunity to really like let our love be the melody. It wasn't about joining up and becoming a band at that point in time. It was really about me getting some healing I needed. I had PTSD from the war, and Tanya was the only one that was identifying it, and she really drove me to getting some help mentally. And then we learned by 2014 that a good way to help me mentally, the best psychiatrist I had was a pen and pad and a keyboard. And love from my family, my wife and my children. And after that, we start studying, and we fell in love with a band called the Civil Wars.
Right.
Yeah, Joy Williams and John Paul White.
Yeah.
And we just thought, well, we could be the black version of them. Oh, God. We can be the more soulful version of them, I guess. But we decided to be a band, you know.
Well, that's interesting. I mean, is that sort of what I was going to ask you? I mean, it's a dumb question. I'm sure you've asked it or answered it 8 million times, but I was going to ask you where the name came from. But that's when you think of the Civil Wars and the Warren Treaty, I mean, I you know.
Man, that's
is that what it was kind of based on?
That's to be honest with you. Yeah, I mean, we were, you know, it was weird. It was a weird obsession because we had several names. I mean, I Ain't Your Sister. We had Dear Martha.
Empty Herb.
Empty Herb. 9 years apart. I mean, like Trotter and Blunt. I mean, so many names, right?
Right. Well, when you and think of duos, like you like, why didn't you just use your names? You know, the Trotters, or you know, Michael and Tanya. You know what I mean? You think of like the Everly Brothers or something. You know, like how come it was a band name instead of that?
A part of me kind of like now
wishes we did.
A part of me like now, I'm like, shit, man. We probably should, because people. I'm gonna tell you why I think that now. Not like, part of me now is like, man, I wish we could rethink this before it gets too out of hand. But so many people think our band name is Warren Treaty.
Warren. Yeah. So which one of you is Warren?
I Warren. But really, honestly, we were watching an interview and saw how the Civil Wars came up with their name.
Mm.
And I was like, we got to have a story. Tanya's like, we got to have a story. And I said, well, we're gonna change our name. And we were arguing literally about changing our name again, and it was heated. And I was like, look, we are changing the name, god damn it, that's what we're doing. And Tanya's like, okay, Michael, this is not the war, and we need to come to some sort of treaty in this. And I was like,
ding.
I think we just did.
Yeah. Well, anybody that's been married for any amount of time knows that there's lots of war and there's lots of treaties. It makes perfect sense.
That's it right there, baby.
Yeah. So from all that, and that's a lot. I mean, you guys have a big backstory. How did you wind up in Nashville? Like, why Nashville? Why not LA or, you know, New York or wherever?
Well, it's crazy because we ended up in Michigan first. Yeah. We were living in Baltimore. Mm-hmm. We went to Michigan, and Michigan really is where we really started to be married.
Mm-hmm.
Michigan taught us a lot.
Yeah, it did.
And you know, and you know, we got management. You know, and we connected with Buddy Miller.
Oh, wow.
And and Don Was actually is who connected us with Buddy Miller.
Yeah.
Oh.
And Don was just saying, like, I remember one conversation. Mm-hmm. He was like, it's happening in Nashville. Like, songwriting and, you know, it's happening. Like, if you just need to spend some time mm-hmm. in Nashville. And we got to Nashville in 2017, I personally was like, oh, hell yeah.
I was not happy.
We're moving. And Tanya was like, no,
I do not want to be in this town.
Why? How come? What turned you off about it?
Well, you know, I had my own ideas for being in LA and New York that it would be pretentious. You know, I wanted to, when I finished working, I wanted it to not be work. You know what I mean?
Right.
Go to the grocery store. You just want to go to the grocery store, walk to your, it was a small town we were living in, walk to your post office, the simple life, you know?
Yeah. And now, Nashville's an industry town, you know?
It's an industry town. And, but I find, and then the good part about it is we ended up being on the road most of the time, so we were never home anyway.
Yeah.
But
it's interesting you say that, though. I mean, it can be. I think any place can be an industry place. Mm-hmm. It all depends on how you are. And the one thing I've learned is, you know, like I've learned my place in Nashville. Like mm-hmm. I've learned my role, and I've learned my role in the industry. You know, like me and Tanya, we're the ones who, if we find out, like for instance, Lainey Wilson, Lainey, you familiar with Lainey?
Yeah, sure.
Lainey put up a post about her dad. Now we've never met Lainey, never had one conversation. But our thing, or you know, the church folk will call our ministry is love. And we sent her dad a balloon in the hospital and, you know, get well. Dave Cobb was the same way, you know, and you know, throughout the pandemic we were texting like Dirks and different artists who we had connected with, like, hey, how's your mental health? Like, are you okay? You know, like, this is before we were ever on any ACMs with him or anything like that. And you know, it's not about professional gang or kudos. It's really about helping our industry see that, or helping our industry be reminded that we are people. You know, we tend to put the artist badge on and we leave it there. And now we become artists. But the reality of the situation is, you know, there are some days where I want to text you, Chris, and just say, Chris, how you doing this morning? Are you okay?
Yeah.
You know,
I'm not okay. I'm just kidding. Yeah.
But it's real. You know, there were times where I'll leave an artist's name out, but I would text a big artist, you know, and just say, hey, I'm just reaching out for nothing, just to say, hey, man, I'm thinking of you today. And Ty and I, you know, we actually said a little prayer for you. And that artist would write back and say things like, I need to talk to you then, because mm-hmm. I'm not okay, like you said. You know, and I realize that there's a lot of that in Nashville. There's a lot of, Nashville's the one place where if you confront someone with the real, they'll go like, oh,
they won't put on a face.
I gotta deal with this. And that's me and Tanya's place in this industry, you know, even when we sing, right? There's a reason why you, no matter what lifestyle you live, there's a reason why when you hear Ray Charles, or when you hear Nina Simone, or when you hear, you know, Notorious B.I.G. even, it's something so real, it's something so gut-wrenching that it changes you, you know, it reminds you. And our voices and our experiences remind so many people of the ancestry of our of people in this country, you know, and we understand that and we don't run from that, you know. So I found that we had a place in Nashville, you know, and I found that we had a place in country music for those very reasons, you know, and we have a place in blues, and we have a place in Americana.
Right. I mean, so that's an interesting thing. There's a line in one of your songs that says, slinging country gospel. And I was wondering, like, you know, artists tend to kind of be uncomfortable with genre labels and getting stuck in a group or getting pigeonholed, but especially for like your guys' music, that is a mishmash of a lot of different styles and sounds, you know, like it probably, I'm guessing it doesn't matter much to you. You just make your music or whatever, like the way it gets pigeonholed, but it matters to like your manager and your label and, you know, they're trying to market you and all that stuff. So do you think about that stuff? Like, where do you feel like you slot in? Or does it matter?
It doesn't matter. It's actually intentional. You know, I think that one of the things about being a brown or black person in America is that you're always trying to find yourself in it all, not realizing that you are an American. You know, blues is an American sound. Americana is an American sound. Country music is an American sound. Folk music, all of it comes from America, you know, and to be able to take all these sounds and put inside of music, you know, it's just saying, the music itself is saying, I'm American, and it just happens to go into Americana. So I think it's intentional to infuse everything that's inside of us. And we always say when Michael and I talk, that it's an example of what our love sounds like.
Yeah, I was going to say, it's not music at all. Yeah. In fact, what it is like what's on, it is an example of the style of love we have for one another. Mm-hmm. One day, our love may sound like the sacredness of Mahalia Jackson or gospel music or Christian music. Another day, our love may sound like rock and roll or straight rock. You know, you're hearing the sounds of our love, us making love, creating love, you know. And if you want to get the best out of us, don't pigeonhole that, you know, don't put any parameters on there. And I'm grateful because Ty and I, we were signed to Universal, but the president of the label was like adamant about not changing who we are. She's like, listen, this is why we fell in love with you all. And we want to try something new. We want to try something different. And that moved us.
Yeah, that completely moved us. And one thing I love about the industry right now is that you can be on playlists. People create their own list, what they want to listen to. You can't sell them the way you used to could sell them. Mm. They know what they want to hear. They'll create a playlist and listen to it. You know, I got a daughter, and I'm sure your son does the same thing. They listen to every genre of music. There's not one genre that they're pigeonholed to because of radio. The fans have freed themselves from radio. The industry's trying to learn how to, you know.
Well, you know, we talked a lot about the industry. I mean, and I know you guys aren't like a mainstream country band per se, but you do, you know, you live in Nashville and you're playing on the ACMs and things like that. So you're in that space. I mean, what's your take on like, you know, I don't live in Nashville. I'm not really in the country music industry exactly. I'm more of a fan and a, you know, from the outside looking in, it looks like it's, you know, there's a lot more black artists nowadays having success within country music. And so what's your take on like this industry's embrace of artists like yourselves who just a few years ago, to be polite, would have been not as welcome?
Yeah, I agree. I think, and, you know, I might be a little controversial saying this. I think there's more black people in the space of country music and not in the success of country music.
Mm.
Like, for me, that there's a difference there. Like, you know, you have your Jimmys and Mickey. You know, you have your even Darius Rucker. And Kane, but when you look at the charts and when you look at the tours, you know, like, man, like, for instance, Luke Combs' tour had his opener was Jordan Davis, like, and Lainey Wilson. That's Luke Combs. You know what I'm saying? Like, think about that. Like, that is the success of country music. But there is a hope there when you see a War and Treaty, or, you know, there's a hope there when you see a band like Cat and Alex, or, you know, Breland. You know, the hope is that country music and the industry would realize the opportunity it can give itself when you let those gates open up. And they should never been closed in the first place. Music, you know, it's so interesting. We believe we own the lanes of music. Everybody believes it. It's like, you know, rock should be this. And I remember a lot of country music fans were like, well, if it doesn't have a banjo and a fiddle in it, it ain't country.
Right.
You know, and you start doing all of that. But I remember listening to an interview with Duke Ellington, and he got extremely offended when they called his music jazz. He said, don't call my music jazz. He said, I don't make jazz music. I make music. I fell in love with music. You
right.
know, and
right.
So I just feel that
because it's all some pentatonic scales with some blue notes thrown into it, sort of regardless of if it's country, blues, rock and roll. You know what I mean?
It's all relative, yeah. And I feel that you know, I just feel privileged to be able to have this idea and this perception of what it is. You know, and to stay humble and grateful for every opportunity to get on the stage and to represent. Like the CMAs was powerful because we got on the stage and we represented, you know, the CMAs. We represented ourselves. We represented the American people, and we represented change and growth. There's never been a black husband and wife duo perform on that stage ever. And I think that we can't ignore that. We gotta realize that that happened.
Yeah.
And some young husband and wife who don't even know they're gonna be married yet, but they'll remember when they are trying to be country music artists that they saw the War and Treaty on this stage, you know, with Brothers Osborne, yeah. Who also has a gay male in the band. Like, this was a monumental moment, yeah. You know.
Right. Right.
On this award show. And so, yeah, you know, that's what I feel. I feel that we got to be grateful and we have to be aware of where things can change. We'll be grateful for the change that has already taken place.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting because, you know, there's the sort of the industry side of it and the people in Nashville, and Nashville is like a big metropolitan town and all that. So I'm curious, like what it's like, you know, the reality is we still live in a very polarized, you know, the times we're living in are extremely polarized and people are, you know, like, it seems to me everywhere you go, it's like the minute like politics or race or anything becomes a topic, people get nuts, you know? So yeah. is the difference, like, what's your experience been? It's one thing in Nashville, within the industry. It's another thing out on the road, like taking it to the people, opening up for bands, you know, in the country music space and all that sort of thing. How have like the fans embraced you? When you're maybe playing to people that aren't your, you know, like that haven't heard your band before, you're walking out there, it's the first time they've ever seen you, kind of those kind of situations.
If you would have asked us this before the CMAs, I would have had a different response.
Yeah.
But we did the CMAs, right? And then we went and did a show in Washington, D.C. Up until that point, our crowd had been about 95, and this is no exaggeration, 95% white, our audience. But when we went to D.C., our audience was about 45% black, which we had never had happened before.
Yeah.
Tanya, we performed a couple of songs and everyone was hyped. And then Tanya said, well, this week we did something cool. We got a chance to perform on CMAs. Chris, when I tell you, the building erupted and all these people in the audience, black or white, they stood up and applauded. I looked in the front row and a couple of black people had tears streaming down their face.
Mm.
I was like, what the?
Whoa.
Yeah.
It meant so much to them to see us there. And a writer who reviewed the show, he said the ovation took 3 minutes long.
Yeah. Mm.
They were cheering. And then the next show, we saw the same kind of boost. And the next show, the same kind of boost. Black people, it's not the shock that white people were there and white people were accepting or none of that. It's the shock that black people were there.
Yeah.
And black people.
Yeah.
Black people were accepting.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, as we talk about the polarization of what's happening in our country, it's interesting because I always tell Michael about this. My mother came over here. She was from Panama. And, you know, one of the things that I watched growing up was watching how even in my own community, people adjusting to her accent, you know, Spanish speaking accent. So when you grow up and you see that kind of, you know, I would get teased in school because she had a Spanish accent. They never heard anybody sound like that and look like us. You know, we were still black. We had an accent. So I think that what America is doing is we're trying our best. The only country, not the only country, but the major country that takes all these different immigrants and puts them in the space of America. And we all try to figure out how to live together, you know, how to respect one another's differences. And the benefit of growing up in Washington, D.C. is that we would take trips to the embassies downtown, you know, and we would be able to experience the Ethiopian embassy and the Israeli embassy and go to all these different places and learn all these different cultures from young, you know, when you were younger. And I think that now the majority of America is having to face what most people that grow up in areas like Washington, D.C. or New York or certain areas in California have always had to deal. We've always had to learn how to adjust and enjoy each other's foods and enjoy each other's cultures because that's the America that we grew up in. So what's happening is the arms are stretching now. Places that are rural America is now having to see a Spanish country act like Kate and Allie or an act like Michael and Tanya show up on the CMAs when they're used to just seeing white people on the show. Or, you know, or if you watch the Spanish awards, someone will show up that's dark skin that speaks Spanish. That's an adjustment in the Hispanic culture. Mm. It's an adjustment if you see a black business billionaire, you know? So all these things are an adjustment.
Oh, shit, that's Tanya. Happening.
I won't touch that. What? But it's an adjustment.
Watch it now.
It's an adjustment for us as Americans. But the beautiful thing about that is we can adjust. And that's the hope that, you know, I look at. I look at how it was for me when I was little and watching my neighbors adjust to, you know, my mother being the first Hispanic in her lineage to be on American soil, you know, and that's the part of America and music and culture that we have to get. If not, we're going to go back into this unnecessary cycle.
Well, there's a way you get that. Mm-hmm. I think what we've done is this. We have done a great job as a country of preserving and holding true the stories of our mothers and our fathers. You know, like I love when Tanya brings up her mom and father, whatever. But the truth of the matter is, but if you lived your life strictly based on your story, you'll realize just how much change has occurred in your family through you.
That's right.
Like, you don't have, Chris, probably the same experience or stories with someone who doesn't look like you as your parents. You know, you've gone probably a lot further in stretching across the aisles, you know, and I have for sure. In fact, just recently, we were going to, in 2020, we went to Selma, Alabama. Actually, we went to Alabama to march with John Lewis, you know, and lead his march and song. It was his final march. My father's from Birmingham, Alabama. When he found out, he got extremely terrified. You know, and he's born in the 50s. And he's like, you can't trust those white people. And he got terrified. And it just helped me realize he doesn't have the stories I have.
Yeah.
He doesn't have the experiences I have. And what I can't do is, out of my loyalty to my father and out of my loyalty to his story, I cannot take his fear and then make it my own.
Exactly.
You know, I've got to be able to put my arms around him and say, I know how you feel. I know you have a valid fear, but let me share with you what has happened in my life, my experiences, you know, and then we can all start to move forward based on where we are, you know, that history, it is history, but it doesn't have to be my history necessarily. It doesn't have to be your history. Mm-hmm. In fact, it's actually not. It's just history that has happened. Mm-hmm. But my history with white people, my history with black people, with Asian people, people, period. My history has been love abounds. Mm-hmm. You got some bad apples everywhere, but love wins at the end of the day. And, you know, and Ty and I, what we've been doing is we've been working on referencing ourselves as the talking point and realizing, like, listen, we've been on the road, Chris. We were called niggers by a festival promoter. And we realized that our power is, we'll never go back there, you know, and perform for that guy. Or maybe we do. And we keep doing it until he understands who we really are.
Mm.
And he understands what's acceptable in this, in our new world that we're all building. We're evolving this world, you know.
Wow, that's heavy duty. I mean, you think of that like, you know, that would be something Ray Charles would have experienced, but you don't think that, or you would like to think that it's not as overt nowadays. That's really, that makes me really sad to hear that, that's like, what was the context of that moment?
Well, we were at a festival and, you know, we sang and people really were just floored by what me and Tanya had done out there. And but he didn't know I was walking, you know, when we got done. He didn't know I was in his vicinity. So let me say, he didn't look at me and Tanya and go, "You niggers," you know. He said to another artist, "Now that we got the loudmouth niggers out the way, and you know, we can go ahead and get your stage set up, buddy." And the artist just kind of looked at him like, "Wow." But the artist didn't defend us, you know, didn't say, "Man, don't you know." But me and Tanya, we've had those kind of experiences before. There was one time we were over in Canada, believe it or not.
Yeah.
And the waiter came and it was myself. Tanya wasn't sitting there, but it was me, my tour manager, who was a white lady at the time, and then these two artists who were both white, you know. And the waiter came over there and he served them impeccably. You know, he was like, "What can I do for you?" You know, and then when it came time for me to order, I said, "I would like such and such." And he was like, "Well, we don't have that." I was like, "Okay, I would like this." He was like, "No, you need to get this." And then I was like, "Well, I don't want that." He's like, "Well, you're going to get that." And then he kind of like snatched my menu, and everyone saw this. And it was my, you know, my tour manager who jumped up, you know, and she ran over there and just went off, you know, and just told the restaurant what had happened. And, you know, and they just was like, you know, they tried to comp my meal, you know, and that kind of thing. But what I did was I tipped this waiter. I wrote on his paper, you know, "I'm sure you just had a bad day, and hopefully this will help your day." And I tipped him $100.
Jesus.
Yeah.
I mean, it's amazing that you can be so kind and like in the face of that kind of ugliness. I mean, I think that says a lot about you. It's depressing to hear that's still part of the touring experience, you know, in 2022 or whenever it was. But I think that says a lot about you.
I wasn't trying to be valiant. What it was for me, you know, I put back on the skin of soldier. You know, like, my responsibility is to, you know, protect these freedoms. My responsibility is to show, is to lead by example, you know, and to say, you know what, you know, because I could have, you know, to be honest with you, Chris, I mean, if I acted on how I emotionally felt, I could have tore that whole restaurant up, you know?
Right. You know? Right, yeah, sure.
But at that point, I recognized the responsibility, right? It's like, but what would happen if I did that?
Yeah.
You know, like, you know what? I'm going to see this deeper. That is, that takes a lot of swallowing. That takes a lot of stomping on your pride. And that takes a lot of honesty. You know, and the honest part is, if Tanya had been there, would it have gone down that way? I can't honestly say, looking at you in good faith, that I'd be that calm. You know, I probably feel disrespected and feel like, you know, my woman's here, man.
Right. Oh, yeah, sure. Yeah.
But yeah.
Well, heavy, man. We got into some heavy territory. you know, you guys have been fucking fantastic. It's great talking to you. It's great meeting you. I don't want to take up too much of your time. We've been going for a minute. It's great. I'm sure you have much to get to.
Oh, thank you. We really appreciate it.
Thanks for choosing us to talk to today, man.
Oh my goodness.
thanks for coming and doing it and doing it early. And like I said, I'm sure you got plenty to get to, but I appreciate it. And I appreciate you guys. You guys are great.
Thanks, bro.
Yeah.
We appreciate you. And thank you all for inspiring us. You give us the food we need. Thank you.
Yeah. Well, I hope at some point we get to actually meet in person and, you know, share a stage together and be at a festival or whatever, you know, like somewhere down the road. I'm out in Nashville from time to time, so.
Yeah.
I'm gonna check in with you. I'm gonna be like, how are you feeling today?
Thanks, bro.
Awesome, man. Take care, you guys.
See you later, man.
Yeah, see you soon.
Happy holidays.
Ah, thank you. You too. Oh yeah, that was Michael and Tanya from the Warren Treaty. They're cool as hell. I had a great time talking to them. And I really am going to bother them next time I'm in Nashville. You just wait. I'm coming. I'm coming soon. February 10th, opening up for Blackberry Smoke. Don't forget, February 15th, new single, Blacktop White Lines, comes out to all the DSPs. You can't escape me, internet. I'm coming. All right, that was a lot of fun. And I will be back in a couple weeks, probably, with another episode. See you then. Adios, amigos!